So I want, for the rest of the talk, really, to look at some of the actions of Zen masters. We've seen how some of them get on. I want to see how they behaved in their maturity to get a sense of what it might be like to go into the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. So this shouldn't be too challenging, this talk. I gather some of them might have been. You can just sit back and enjoy. Many Chan and Zen monks, after years spent practicing in monasteries and studying with great masters, although usually there was only one master that was their main, that they mainly followed, so they really put the bucket down deeply into the well. Many of them, after their awakening, they eventually established monasteries of their own, or took over old monasteries in order to communicate their experience to others. And in a way, there's not a lot to say about this. In a way, there's a lot to say, but it's not particularly interesting, in a way. The daily routine of the monastery, the daily routine of practice. I mean, there's not a lot to say about the washing up, is there? And, you know, serving meals and the day-to-day of practice that we've been doing this last week. There's not a lot to say. But what I find interesting about this is that the bliss-bestowing hands created and maintained practice institutions, environments of practice, places where you could meditate, study, and live with companions in the Dharma, and work for the Dharma, and serve the local community. Monasteries in the ancient Buddhist world were important focal points for the villages around, for the whole country. The bliss-bestowing hands just set that up and made sure it kept happening. And I think this is very important. In a way, it's not very exciting, but absolutely necessary. Just the work of setting up places. You know, we sit here in this fantastic shrine room, in this incredible place. Well, this has come from the work of many, many people. Many bliss-bestowing hands has made this possible. And when I think back to some of the retreat venues that I've had to go to, you know, in India and other places, which, and the amount of effort that went into just, you know, trying to have a retreat in very difficult circumstances, you really appreciate, you know, what you've got in a place like this. Sometimes people say they want, you know, they want adventure, they want to take initiative and, you know, make things happen. And that's very exciting, and it does really build your character if you take something on. But check this out. There's Master Yanqi, who became abbot of Mount Yanqi. And when he took it over, the monastery buildings were old and decayed. They were barely able to keep out wind and rain. And when snow and hail fell, it just pelted the monks seated on the meditation platforms. Maybe they were like this. So imagine, you know, this doesn't have a proper roof, and snow and rain and hail is pelting down on you. And of course, the monks volunteered sincerely to do the place up, to make it better. And Master Yanqi said, no, no. He said, the Buddha says our lifespan is uncertain. It's always decreasing, and the highlands and valleys are always changing. In the past, the great sages sat under trees to meditate. All of you have only just left home. You're still youngsters in your 40s and 50s. How can you waste your time in leisure in comfortable buildings? And the next day he gave them a poem. When I began living in this building with crumbling walls, all the meditation platforms were covered by jewels of snow. Scrunching up my shoulders to my neck, I exhaled into darkness, reflecting on the ancient Buddha abiding under a tree. So that might be a bit much for us. But, you know, there's an example of going into the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. But we need good places with roofs, places to practice in, to study in, to reflect on the Dharma, to come together in, to come together with others, to work with others. One of the things Sangharakshita, our teacher, has placed great stress on over the years is the importance of our centres and our retreat centres and our right livelihood businesses and all the different things that we have. And some people have felt that he sort of placed too much stress on that, but I must say I disagree, because without supportive conditions, good physical conditions, spiritual practice is actually very, very difficult. Very, very difficult, and we shouldn't underestimate it. If we lost all our centres and communities and business overnight, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I mean, we've still got a vibrant spiritual community. But I think some people would have a very, very hard time. They'd have a very, very hard time, especially the people who don't appreciate these things. They'd have a very, very tough time. So we need to reflect on this. Bliss-bestowing hands don't just touch and leave you with a nice groovy feeling. Bliss-bestowing hands make dead trees bloom. They make you bloom. They make places where you can bloom. They create a world in which you can practice and work together. And it takes real work to do this, real steady work, rolling up your sleeves kind of work, completely glamorous kind of work. You know, I think of dear old Osada, you know, behind his desk doing, you know, doing the books, you know, totally unglamorous, totally unsung. Nobody comes and says, what a fantastic set of figures. But if he didn't do it, we'd be in a right old state.